Good evening. I think the microphone is working. Yes, good. Thank you all for coming in on a dark night. Winter time, it is kind of you to come. And I'm very glad to have the opportunity to be here tonight. I want to tell you a story, the story of the discovery of pulsars when I was a graduate student. But I am experimenting with the venue. The first question is, will the slide machine work from this distance? Yes. Good. So this is a photograph taken from my high school. It was a girls' boarding school. I started life in the north of Ireland, where the education was not very good, especially for girls. Girls did cookery and needlework. Boys did science. I wanted to do science. I and two other girls were the first girls to do science in that school. The teacher thought we were dynamite. He made us sit right up against his desk. We did physics the first term. I loved it. I came top of the class without trying. I got 97%, and the thing I got wrong was the speed of light. We worked in old British units. Question, what is the speed of light? And I write down 186,000 miles per second, because we learnt the old British system. That was actually right. But I looked at that number for the first time in my life and thought, that's very big, and changed miles per second to miles per hour. I still came top in the exam. So I was pleased at that. Our parents had had a fight to get girls to do science, and a girl comes top in the first exam. We did chemistry next term. Okay, not as good as physics. And in the third term, we did biology. Here is a flower. Draw the flower, label the parts, learn the names. You've done that. Good. Here's another flower. Draw the flower, label the parts, learn the names. We did that for the whole term. I thought, boring. So I've had a prejudice against biology ever since. But I think it's true to say that physics has been my best subject. And at school leaving, I did maths and physics. I went and was architect for the planetarium at Armagh Observatory. And occasionally I would go with him when he was on a visit to the observatory. I was quite useful. I was a small child. There were leaks in the roof. I could crawl into the small spaces and say, there, that's where the leak is, because I was only a child. I had become interested in astronomy, and then one of the astronomers at Armagh Observatory said, you know, you'd be working at night. You have to be very good at staying awake at night. Oh. I knew I couldn't stay awake at night. I needed my sleep. And then I got to hear about radio astronomy, picking up the radio waves from stars and galaxies. And in radio, the sun does not dominate the way it does in the visible. Daytime to radio astronomy is not any brighter than nighttime. And so you can do radio astronomy day and night. And that tends to mean that the astronomers, the radio astronomers, work in daytime, mostly. So, okay, I'll be a radio astronomer. And after I finished my degree, I went to Cambridge University to do radio astronomy. Cambridge has a very prestigious reputation. And I had never been to that part of England before. And I arrive and there's these young men talking in the streets. I think Plato was actually talking about, no. What about what Euripides said? And I'm, oh, my God. They're all terribly clever here. I'm not clever enough for this place. In case any of the young people here sometimes think that, here's my recipe for dealing with it. Maybe you are not clever enough. Maybe you are going to be thrown out because you fail exams. But until you are thrown out, you work your very hardest so that when they throw you out, you'll know you've done your best and you just weren't good enough. And that was my policy in Cambridge. I was working very, very hard, being very, very thorough, but did not expect to get a degree. I expected they'd say, go home, Justin. But partly because I was being very thorough, things changed. When you join the Cambridge Radio Astronomy Group, you get given a set of tools. These were the first tools I'd ever used. Well, not used, the first I'd ever owned, my own. And I still have them. These are not microelectronics tools. These are full-size wire-working tools. There were other tools that were available for people to use. The other one I used most often was a sledgehammer because I spent some of the time hammering posts into the ground. Because for the first 2 years, I was helping build a radio telescope. A radio telescope that worked at 81.5 megahertz. That's a wavelength of, I think, 3.7 meters. Quite a long wavelength. Over 2,000 antennae. 192 kilometers of wire and cable. And it covered an area of 57 tennis courts. It took six of us 2 years to build. And for the physicists in the audience, we have some low-loss cables. I've put the plugs and sockets on the end. In winter, I have a little hut here where I sheltered, putting the plugs and sockets on this end. And there's another little hut down there at the other end of the cables where I put plugs and sockets on the other end. And we are now checking the connections. It was not expensive. £12,000, even back then, was not a lot of money. It took six of us about 2 years to build. And I label this photograph typical working conditions for a PhD student. A slight exaggeration, but actually in radio astronomy, about par for the course. This is the completed array. This is actually a radio telescope. It works at a wavelength of about 3.7 meters, so it's quite long wavelength, quite big antennae. It covers an area of 57 tennis courts. You won't know what acres are, I'm sorry, but, or you probably know what hectares are, but 57 tennis courts. And the most notable things are the wooden posts. These are simply to keep all the bare wires away from the wet grass, because wet grass is an electrical short, and you lose your signal. If wet grass touches bare conductors, the signal will run to earth very quickly. We could have operated with 16 beams, but we couldn't afford 16 receivers. We only had four receivers, so we used four beams. And the receivers used what in Britain we called valves, what the Americans called vacuum tubes. Transistors were barely in, and everybody was a bit conservative. Oh, they're noisy. Oh, they're unreliable. We're not using them. They did ultimately change, but not at this stage. Now, what exactly is going on? Way up top of this slide, there is a quasar, and actually it ought to be much, much further up. And down here you can see the ground with a radio telescope. And in between the two comes the solar wind. Let me come round to the other slide and do some pointing. So here's the radio telescope. Your quasar is away up there. And the space in between, or some of the space in between, is filled with the solar wind, plasma blowing out from the sun. The plasma is not perfectly smooth. You can think of it as having clouds with higher electron density. And I'm going to do this in terms of physics. So physics students, listen up for a moment. This sequence of clouds serves like a diffraction grating. And if you shine a beam on a diffraction grating, you get maxima coming out at various angles. But this diffraction grating is blowing past as the solar wind goes out. And so you get changes in what you pick up down here. And the signal you receive keeps varying. And this is on a 1 second time scale, given the solar wind, the rate it's moving, and so on. For the non-physicists, there's stuff coming out from the sun all the time. And it interferes with the radio waves. And if you have a very compact radio source, it makes the radio signal jiggle up and down like that. If you have a compact radio source, like a quasar. Quasar is quasi-stellar, and stars are quite compact. So quasars are compact. But radio astronomers also knew of radio galaxies which were not compact, were extended objects. And an extended object would be viewed through maybe a couple of clouds and a gap, all at the same time. And so the clouds blowing past didn't have the same effect. And for a broad source like a radio galaxy, the signal would be pretty steady. So I'm looking for things that produce a signal that jitters up and down or scintillates, and that would be a quasar. At the time I started, I think there were about 15 or 20 quasars known, and by the time I'd finished, I got the number up to about 200. So along with not being able to use transistors, we didn't have much computer access. At that time, the University of Cambridge had one computer, and it had memory comparable to the memory of your laptop for the whole university. It also took up a whole room because we didn't have much in the way of transistors. We were using what the Brits call valves, what the Americans call vacuum tubes. And so your equipment was huge in size and needed a lot of cooling as well. Took up a whole room. And very few people could have time on it, and we didn't. So our data came out on these long strips of paper chart. I had four charts running at a time, and I was getting 30 meters of these charts each day to analyze. And I'm looking for sources that appear to change in brightness quite fast on a time scale of seconds. 30 meters of paper a day. It took 4 days to do one scan of the sky. That's 120 meters in 4 days. And I ran the survey for 6 months. So I had over 5 kilometers of this paper. They do have computers now, but they were a bit new at that stage. And the idea was that I'd repeatedly map the sky and look for things whose brightness fluctuated. And those would be the quasars. And I also had a way of getting an estimate of their angular diameter. But the main thing was to identify more quasars. We had to use quite short exposures, to use an optical analogy, quite short time constants in order to see these rapid fluctuations. And I did 6 months observing. And in terms of quasars, it was very successful. And I've moved too far from the equipment. Okay, so this is the center scan of my chart recording, and for the people who are used to signal processing, I have taken out the low frequency stuff. It's high pass filtered. I'm not interested in the big drools as the signal goes through. I'm interested in whether there's rapid fluctuations or not. So I'm focusing on what rapid fluctuations there might be. And this is the very first sign I had of something that was a bit unusual. There is some low-level interference on the right-hand half. Because I have this enormous radio telescope, it had an area of 57 tennis courts. It's huge. It's quite sensitive. It picks up anything that gives out radio emission in our band. Our band is supposed to be kept clear. There are several bands kept clear for radio astronomy. Pirate radio stations love them. And it's quite hard to get a pirate radio station closed down, I can tell you. But mostly they were clear. However, on the right-hand half of this bit of chart, there's a bit of what's labelled as interference. Something that I'm not interested in, that's a nuisance, that's giving a bit of radio emission. And on the left-hand half is a signal, and this is actually the first time I saw it, that I couldn't make sense of. It didn't look like one of my twinkling quasars. Didn't actually look quite the same as interference either. And you can perhaps see by looking at those two that they sort of look different. For students in the audience, when you say they look different, you're actually doing Fourier analysis in your head. It is possible to do Fourier analysis in your head, at least broadly speaking. Fourier analysis, you may remember, asks what frequencies are present in this signal and what amplitude do those frequencies have. So looking at the right-hand signal, the one labelled interference, you can see the chart paper between the spikes. Whereas with the left-hand signal, particularly the left-hand edge of it, the spikes are so close you can't see any chart paper. And in the right-hand one, the interference, the spikes go up and down, whereas in the left-hand one, they go mainly up. That last comment about up and down or mainly up is to do with amplitudes. Whether you can see space between the spikes or not is to do with the frequencies. And that's the guts of Fourier analysis. What frequencies are present with what amplitudes? And you're doing it with your eyes. If you're somebody like me that's not too keen on the mathematics, it's worth hanging on to that. But broadly speaking, it looks different. And I didn't quite know what to make of this signal on the left initially. I showed it to my supervisor, who sort of said, have you seen it before? Go back through all your old chart recordings to see if it's been there before. By this stage, I had several kilometers of chart recording. I did, and I realized that there'd been hints of it before, but it was really rather weak. This was the first time you kind of had to pay attention to it. So he said, okay, it's all jammed into 5 millimeters. We can't see what's going on. What we need is an enlargement. Spread it out. Enlargements with chart recorders are easy. You run the paper faster under the pen and it all gets spread out. Hey, hey. Except it gets through the roll of paper in 20 minutes. And so you don't leave the thing running at high speed day and night, or the grad student lives at the observatory day and night putting a fresh roll of paper in every 20 minutes. No, the grad student goes out to the observatory shortly before this bit of sky is going to be viewed, switches to the high-speed recording, switches to that beam, lets it run for 5 minutes, puts it back to as it was. Repeat, repeat, repeat. So this is what it turned out to be when I got that, so to speak, enlargement, this high-speed time recording. Along the bottom are 1 second time marks. There used to be a station in Britain that broadcast these, and they're pretty accurate. And up above is the signal as it came in. The label was added afterwards in my supervisor's handwriting. And it's pretty quiet, but blip, 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 maybe one missing, blip, 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 blip. Maybe a few missing, maybe, maybe, maybe. And these things are spaced at a bit over a second, about 1 1/3 seconds apart. Now, there's an awful lot of things cause radio interference, and I have an enormous radio telescope that will pick up every radio signal going. So presumably this is some kind of interference. Somebody has got some equipment running that produces a pulse every 1 1/3 seconds. It's just the kind of frequency somebody might set a signal generator on. So what could it be? Well, it's coming back every 23 hours, 56 minutes. It's keeping to the sidereal day, not the 24-hour day. So it's other astronomers. They're the only people who keep a 23-hour, 56-minute day. So have some other astronomers had a program going that inadvertently causes this pulsed interference? And alternatively, and even more likely, has Jocelyn wired the radio telescope up wrong? And this is something to do with some crazy wiring. So as our next job, we quietly asked a colleague and his grad student, who also had a radio telescope operating at the same frequency, and asked them if they could see if their telescope, their receiver, their pen recorder picked up this. Robin was the grad student on that project. And I vividly remember the day of that test. The way our telescopes were aligned, my telescope saw it first. It was pulsing nicely. And then we all went and stood by Robin's pen recorder, and nothing happened. And my supervisor and Robin's supervisor started walking along this long laboratory saying, now, what could it be that shows in this radio telescope but not that one? Could it be? No, it can't be that, because what about? No, because. And I was padding along behind them, trying to keep up in every sense of the word. Robin stays by his pen recorder. And suddenly there's a shriek from Robin. Here it is! And we all go charging back down the lab. And there it was. Blip, 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 coming in on Robin's radio telescope with Robin's receiver and Robin's pen recorder. So Jocelyn hasn't wired the radio telescope up wrong. It's external to both the radio telescopes. Robin had miscalculated when his telescope would see it by 5 minutes. If he'd miscalculated by 25 minutes, we'd have all gone home, and the story would be different. But it's seen by a separate radio telescope with its own receiver, totally independent set of kit. It can't be interference, or it's very unlikely to be interference, because it keeps to this sidereal day, keeps its place amongst the constellations, comes back every 23 hours, 56 minutes. We're now clear it's not faulty equipment. But there's an intrinsic problem. It's pulsing very fast. It's not getting tired. We don't see the pulse period changing. It keeps beating and keeps beating at the same rate. And yet the pulses are quite short and steep, so it must be something small. So it's something small with big reserves of energy and can keep pulsing without getting tired. And it's not clear what it is. With radio telescopes, you can measure a quantity called dispersion. I find this a bit hard to explain to an audience that's not scientific, but anybody who's played around with glass cubes in sunlight or glass prisms in sunlight will have seen the sunlight split into a rainbow, because the different frequencies go through that block of glass at different rates and different angles. There's something equivalent happening in radio. Different radio frequencies or radio wavelengths may take slightly different paths. And in the case of radio waves, it's electrons in space that cause the high frequencies to arrive before the low frequencies. For physicists, this is a form of dispersion. So if we could see how big a lag there is between a pulse at high frequencies and a pulse at low frequencies, we could make a guess at how many electrons there are in space and get a guess at how far away this thing is. You know, is it on the Earth? Is it in the solar system? Is it in our galaxy? Is it beyond our galaxy? It's probably not, but, you know, we need to ask the question. And we managed to do this by taking some receivers, tuning them up in frequency slightly, some tuning it down slightly in frequency, and seeing that it arrived first in the high frequency, then in the low frequency. And the gap between the two told us how many electrons it had come past. And if you make a guess at how many free electrons there are in space, you can get an estimate of the distance. And it turned out that that one was probably about 200 light years away. So it's way beyond the sun and the planets, but it's within our own galaxy. But it's definitely not on Earth. It's not some guys fiddling around with radio equipment and causing interference. It is out in space and it's beyond the solar system. Now, I had nicknamed these things LGMs. It was strictly a nickname. I thought it very unlikely there were several lots of little green men, all signalling to planet Earth at the same time, all using the same rather stupid technique. But you had to call them something. So they became LGM 1, 2, 3, and 4. If it was little green men, they would probably live on a planet that went round their sun, the way the Earth goes round our sun. And as their planet moves round their sun, you might get a slight Doppler shift. Perhaps the most famous example of Doppler shift is with a railway train going through a station with its whistle going, and you hear whee-oo as it goes past. I don't think I can whistle it, but the note drops. Maybe we could see some sign of movement of this little green man's planet by looking carefully at this dispersion at the different frequencies. Around about this time, I also found a second one, and then a third one. One of them was pulsing much faster. The other three were all 1-point-something seconds, but one of them was just 1/4 of a second, 4 times a second. So this is something rather tinier if it's doing something that fast. So we've established that there are at least 4 of them. There are actually unlikely to be 4 lots of little green men, all deciding to signal to planet Earth, all deciding to use the same rather stupid technique. It's probably something natural. But if it is little green men, they're on a planet that orbits, and we'll get what's called Doppler shifts. You perhaps know the famous example of a train coming past with its whistle going, and as the train goes past, the pitch of the whistle drops. It changes from approaching to receding. So, Jocelyn, keep measuring these things, keep measuring the period as accurately as you can. We want to see if the source is orbiting its parent star. And I couldn't find any sign of change in the period. So we ultimately decide we have to publish. We publish the first one first, and the other 3 follow behind in a second paper. And there was a huge amount of interest. But there was an interesting incident just before it hit the press. Tony decided we ought to give a colloquium in Cambridge University, announcing this stuff before it appeared, before it went public. And so he gave a colloquium in the astrophysics department, explained what we'd found, and said that his favourite model was a very compact kind of star called a white dwarf. And this white dwarf, or these white dwarfs, were oscillating, vibrating, and each time they vibrated, they launched a shock into their atmosphere, which turned into a pulse. So Tony gave this colloquium in Cambridge, gave it a very, very titillating title, and everybody came. And Tony explained what we'd found and what his pet theory was. And at the end of his talk, the first person to speak was perhaps the most famous person in the room, called Fred Hoyle, who'd written a number of science fiction books, but also was a very, very good astronomer and has written some very good basic astronomy books. And Fred had a good Yorkshire accent, and Fred speaks up and says, "I don't think it's a white dwarf. I think it's a neutron star." And he was right. In 40 minutes, that man has assimilated all this new information and hit the right explanation. He was probably also rather pleased to prove the radio astronomers wrong. There was a bit of a running battle between Fred Hoyle and the radio astronomers, because one of the other pieces of research going on in radio astronomy suggested that the universe had an origin, a Big Bang. And Fred did not like that. So anything he could do to make the radio astronomers look daft, he did. But that was the best he could do on this occasion. "I don't think it's a white dwarf. I think it's a neutron star." Nobody had seen neutron stars at that stage. Some mad theoreticians had been studying them, but yeah, they were mad theoreticians. So, you know, okay, let them. They're not doing anybody any harm. It turns out they were right, but never mind. Written up for the newspapers, lots and lots of press interviews, probably the most horrible time of my life. They would meet with Tony Hewish, and he'd tell them all about it, and then he'd happen to mention that there was this female grad student. "Female! Female! Ooh, can we talk to her?" And get the photographer. And the interviews were along the lines of, "How many boyfriends did I have? And what were my bust, waist and hip measurements?" And the photographer would say, "Could I undo some more blouse buttons, please, for the photograph?" It was absolutely horrible. This was 1968, and women were not treated well by the press. Women were perceived as sex objects, full stop. So I had a rather nasty time with that. One of the press people was quite useful to us. He interviewed us and said, "What are you going to call these things?" And we'd given a bit of thought to that. We could have said pulsed radio sources, or we could have said pulsating radio sources. And we opted for pulsating radio sources, because pulsed radio sources might imply that somebody or something was making the pulses. Little green men again. And we wanted to avoid that. So it's pulsating radio sources, said to the journalist. And he said, no, something short. "What about pulsar? We've already got quasars. What about pulsars?" And as you probably know, pulsars they became. Named originally by the science correspondent of the Daily Telegraph. A very conservative paper, but quite a good science correspondent. So that's basically where my story ends. But one of the nice spin-offs of having been involved in the discovery is every so often somebody comes up to me and says, "You know, I nearly discovered pulsars," and tells me the story. And these stories I'm going to repeat. I won't always name the people, but I'm going to repeat the stories because they tell us a lot about the way science works. So this bit of the story is way back in 1957. summertime. We are in the United States at McDonald Observatory, where there's a big telescope. And McDonald Observatory, at McDonald's requirement, was open to the public one night per month. And this is the open evening. The telescope is set on a famous nebula called the Crab Nebula, indeed on the star in the middle of the Crab Nebula, known as Minkowski Star. And a young man called Elliot Moore, who just finished his undergraduate degree, was working there that summer. And people stepped up to the telescope and said, "Oh, gee, wow," whatever Americans said in 1957. And a young woman steps up and says, "That star's flashing." We now know that the Crab pulsar does flash at a rate of 30 times per second, 30 hertz. It's a fairly high frequency, but some people can see it, especially young women. At one time, the power supply in Canada used to be at 30 hertz. And a number of young women in Canada said they could see all the lights and everything flashing. In Britain, we now, well, in most of the Western world now, we work at 50 or 60 hertz. Because some people can see 30 hertz, especially young women. And this is a young woman who says that star's flashing. The night assistant tried to sort of put her off, you know, talked about scintillation and this kind of thing. But she countered with, "No, I'm an airplane pilot." 1957. "My job is to fly aircraft from the manufacturer to the customer. I fly at night. There's not much to do in the cockpit at night. I look at the stars. That star's flashing." Elliot Moore, the young student there for the summer, took note, but nobody followed up. The telescope was trained on the Crab Nebula. We now know that that star flashes 30 times a second. She probably saw it. 1957. We could have anticipated this discovery if they'd believed that young woman. Much more recently, 2007, the Australians do pulsar work in a big way and have a big catalogue, and they suddenly get an excited email from a rather elderly American called Charles Schisler. He spent time in the US military. He was posted to Alaska, to the early warning site, looking for missiles coming in from Russia. When things were quiet, his boss allowed him to play around with the equipment, and he used the receiver to scan the sky and had picked up a number of pulsing sources. He made a list of these sources. He'd done a college degree and done a college course on astronomy. Bless the teacher of that course. He still knew about right ascension declination. He made a rough estimate of the right ascension declination, the sky coordinates, of these pulsing sources that he'd seen, and illegally took that bit of paper away with him when his military service ended. Many years later, he's just discovered the online pulsar catalogue that the Australian radio astronomers maintain, and a number of his pulsing sources are in that catalogue. The Australians quizzed him pretty thoroughly and believe it was genuine. That was 1957. If he hadn't been working for the military, the discovery of pulsars might have been announced way back then. I think I've said most of that. He came to several pulsar conferences and had a ball, which was lovely to see. I think this is my last example, if I remember rightly. It involves Sue Simpkin, who's Canadian, or was Canadian, brought up in Canada at the time when the Canadian power supply was at 30 hertz. She was one of the young women who could see all the lights and everything flashing at 30 times a second in Canada. She knows she can see that frequency. By this stage, she's doing, I think it's ultraviolet, if I remember rightly. And she's got time to take a spectrum of various things, and an eminent Dutch astronomer, Lo Vulture, asks her to take a spectrum of that funny star in the middle of the Crab Nebula, suspected to be the remains of the star that exploded in 1054 AD. Sue takes an ultraviolet spectrum for Lo. She says the spectrum's fairly dull, but she can see a flickering, as if there were waves going out from it. Lo said, nah, couldn't be. But when the discovery of the pulsar was announced, that pulsar, he was man enough to say she must have seen it. And if perhaps he'd been prepared to believe her, they might have published it long before, well, not that long, but a bit before the pulsar in the Crab Nebula was discovered. For my final example, I'm not going to name the people involved because they were rather embarrassed by this. They were making a survey of the whole of the radio sky at 408 megahertz, North Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. And they're using telescopes, wherever, radio telescopes, wherever they can get time. And of course, when you're trying to map the whole sky, there'll be some little bits that you've missed. And they're in their last couple of days observing, filling in these little bits that they've missed. If I remember rightly, they're working at Jodrell Bank, so it's Northern Hemisphere bits. This is pre-computers, they're using pen recorders, and one of the pen recorders is a bit temperamental. It sticks every so often. And in the early hours of one morning, that pen recorder started going wheep, 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 sweep, sweeping across the page. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're not your brightest. And the observer thought, oh, damn it, it's that pen recorder. It's sticking and then unsticking and sticking and unsticking. And he did what you always do to pen recorders. He thumped it. That usually shakes it up sufficiently that it unsticks it. And at the moment he thumped it, it stopped doing its sweeping and behaved properly. He said, ha! Oh, good, put on his coat and went home to bed and did not enter anything in the log book. If he had made an entry in the log book, he could have claimed prior discovery of a pulsar, because that's why the pen was sweeping across the page. I think the other sad thing is, following the announcement of the discovery of the first pulsars, which did not include that one, the people doing that survey didn't think to go back through their data. Well, the group had disbanded. They were all in different places and so on. I want to finish by paying tribute to an Italian scientist, Franco Pacini. A few months before the discovery of pulsars, Pacini published a paper in the leading magazine, science magazine, Nature. One of the big problems at that time was why the Crab Nebula kept shining. We knew it was the remains of a star that exploded in 1054 AD. It ought to have faded somewhat by now, and it was showing no signs of fading. Franco proposed that maybe in the middle of the Crab Nebula, there was a neutron star with a large magnetic field. And the magnetic axis inclined to the spin axis, so the magnetic field combed around as the star spinned. This would produce something called magnetic dipole radiation, and if that radiation got trapped in the plasma of the nebula, it would keep the nebula shining. And we now know that that's exactly what was happening. But at that particular stage, we didn't know about, well, a few of us knew about pulsars, but the world at large didn't. It wasn't published. And we now know that Franco's explanation of why that nebula is still shining so long after 1054 AD is exactly right. He was an amazing scientist and a very nice man as well. So last couple of slides. Why did this happen when it happened? We had our own telescope and our own receiver, and I made it my job to make sure I understood them all. I'm a graduate student, a research student. I've got nothing else to do in a sense, so I've got time and space to follow up anomalies. And remember, I'm not bright enough to be in Cambridge. They're going to discover their mistake and they're going to throw me out. But until they throw me out, I'm going to work my very hardest. This is imposter syndrome. So I'm being extremely thorough. This was one of the first observations with a short time constant, with a rapid response. What some people would say, it's moving into a new area of phase space. And we didn't have to rush to get a paper out because we weren't aware of any other observers likely to make or announce the discovery before us. We had a good address. Cambridge has got quite a good reputation, a reputable laboratory, so that helped. But it's been the fashion in Britain that you declare what the objectives or the goals or the targets are of your research program when you ask for funding. And then you get a grade depending on how well you've lived up to those predictions. This couldn't have been one of the things that would come out of the program. So I don't know how they'd have managed that. If we had been able to computerize the search, would we have looked at these kinds of frequencies? I wonder. And for a long time in recent decades, low frequency radio waves, radio astronomy, and the time domain have been rather neglected. This is at last changing, I'm very happy to say, and now there's quite a lot of material. I think I've probably talked for long enough, so I won't bore you with the physics of pulsars. Don't go there. They're not healthy. Thank you for your interest. Thank you for your attention.